Hello, loyal OWL podcast listeners. I wanted to take this moment before the podcast begins to apologize for the delayed release of this podcast. After we recorded this episode, life got a little crazy. I traveled for work a bunch, and then Jerry ended up going on his honeymoon. We will try to get on a little more of a regular schedule and release more episodes going forward. Once again, thank you for being a loyal listener, and I hope you enjoy this episode of A Conversation on Morality, Part 2. Okay, and welcome to the OWL Podcast. My name is Jameson, and I am here with Jerry. Jerry, how are you doing, bud?
I'm doing great.
Good. And we once again have Dustin, who is our special guest today. If you guys listened to our last episode, A Conversation on Morality, Dustin was our special guest on that, and we kind of wanted to bring him back on to continue that conversation and just kind of elaborate a little bit more on that. So, Dustin, how are you doing?
I'm feeling special.
Feeling special. Good. So if you guys haven't listened to that podcast yet, I'd recommend that you do. It was about an hour and a half. We had a pretty good conversation. We got a really good view of like what Dustin believes, what Jerry believes, what I believe, as far as, you know, God, morality, things of that nature. And we started to kind of get into a little bit of that, but we ran out of time. Quick synapse of that, though, is Dustin is a practitioner of the Christian faith. Jerry is an atheist, and I'm somewhere in between, just, I would say, like a theist, basically. And we kind of talked a little bit about Dustin's beliefs and how, like, he essentially came to those beliefs and how that's shaped his worldview. Jerry talked about how he has some questions about God and, you know, suffering and man and stuff like that, and that's how it's kind of led him to more atheist type views and so on and so forth. So we started talking a little bit about, you know, some different philosophy type questions, and like I said, unfortunately we just ran out of time, but that's a quick synapse of it. But I would highly recommend you go and listen to that podcast. So anyway, figure we can go ahead and just dive right back in.
I think a good question would be, was anybody's opinions changed, or did we all just entrench ourselves even further in our beliefs, as we have the nasty tendency to do?
That's a good question. That's a really good question, because it actually... So some of the things you said, Jerry, got me thinking, and didn't necessarily change my point of view, but it did want me to essentially clarify some things that you said. So... one of the things that you asked both Dustin and myself is our views on God, like what we actually believe in God, like who is God to us. And then some of the other things that you started talking about when you were talking about like why you don't believe in God, you talked about, you know, humankind's been around for 100,000 years, and it wasn't until essentially the last several thousand years of human existence that God essentially had showed himself, started becoming more helpful, things of that nature. But one of the questions I had for you that you asked us that we didn't ask you, just because we assume since you're an atheist that you don't have a view on God, but I think we should ask to kind of get your clarifications, is who is God to you, Jerry?
Right. So that 100,000 year is kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing that I heard from Christopher Hitchens. He said it as a joke, but I think the point still stands. God to me, it doesn't... I don't like framing the conversation like that, because my interpretation of what God is, it just... I don't know how to start this, but atheism is just a position that there's insufficient evidence for whatever the argument is being presented, right? So take something like, let's divorce everything from, you know, Christian theology. Let's just say something like Islam, right? Islam presents an argument and says, Muhammad was the last prophet of God. God spoke to him through the angel Gabriel. And we have the recitation or the Quran, you know, to follow the word of God. And then we also have the hadiths, which are a way to live your life, right? They follow the life of Muhammad. As a non-theist or as an atheist, right, a non-believer, you would go, okay, I can assess that evidence. and I don't believe it because I have other evidence that would contradict the evidence, you know, posited by Islam, right? So, for example, I don't believe that horses can fly, which is a common belief in Islam, right? They believe that Muhammad rode a winged horse through three cities throughout the night, and then he carved the moon in half, right? So a lot of the things posited by, you know, and then we can jump back into the question, what is God, right? A lot of the things posited by religious belief, as an atheist, you would say, okay, I can examine the evidence, and it doesn't make sense with our understanding of reality. So to answer your question, Jameson, when you say, what is God to me, it would honestly just depend on whoever's putting forth the evidence and making that claim, right? I don't have a definition of God because I don't believe in God, and I'm not putting forth a claim that there is a God. So I guess I don't really have an answer for you as to what I think God is. But not to skirt the question, but I think ultimately what I think people think God is an omnipotent presence that neither intervene or doesn't intervene in our universe. So I guess that's what I think God is.
So to clarify upon that, then atheism is just a point of view that says you don't necessarily accept the religious aspect of God, or that you just don't see that there is an evidence that supports God.
Yeah, atheism, I guess, atheism would be the position, and I know that atheism is kind of, there's sort of a negative connotation when you start to think about socialism and communism and, you know, that aspect of atheism. But the way I understand atheism is you're posited an argument by a religious person, right? Whatever their argument might be, you examine the evidence, or, you know, you examine the claims, and you go, I don't believe the claims put forth because of XYZ, right? So like I said, you know, a Muslim would put forth the evidence and say Muhammad was the last prophet. Me as the atheist, me as the person on the other side, right? Let's not even classify me as an atheist. Me on the person being posited the argument would go, I see your argument. Here's why I think it's wrong. But because we need a term to classify me, you would then say, okay, well, he's an atheist because he doesn't believe, right? So that would be my definition of atheism, and subsequently what I think God is.
So, to keep elaborating on this, so it's basically when you come from you're talking from a religious point of view that you essentially don't believe in the religious God. Is that what I'm understanding? So for me, or for, you know, Dustin, you know, who's a Christian, or if a Jew or a Muslim present their God to you, you don't necessarily believe in that version of God, but you might actually have your own version of something that you believe in that maybe you don't understand?
No, I don't have a version of... So are you asking if I think there's a creator of the universe, or some, like, what I would think God is?
Well, based on some of the arguments that you've had, is that you can't understand, like, one of the things you said with essentially suffering is you don't understand how a God, you know, based on the Christian God, the Muslim God, the Jewish God, would allow something like suffering or something like that to happen, that, you know, a creator of that kind of thing would exist in this universe, that you don't necessarily accept that. So what I'm asking is if you believe that there is some kind of creator, or if there is something that you believe differently, or if you just had a fail expectations of what people think God is.
I see. I don't believe there is a God. I think we can explain the universe without invoking a God. So, and this is when we got into that part of the conversation where we explained about, you know, suffering. So suffering to me makes sense without a God, because right, the universe is random, events are random, and people suffer. Say somebody gets cancer, right? That just happens randomly. So what I was suggesting at the time was, what I don't understand is if there is a God and he can allegedly intervene in our lives, like, why allow all this suffering, right? Why allow somebody to get cancer when they're 35, right? So that's what I was arguing at the time.
Right, and what I'm saying with that, though, is that seems like it's a misunderstanding of what possibly God could be to maybe you. Like, you might actually believe that there is something, but you don't necessarily understand what it is because you can't acknowledge, or you don't understand why, if there is a God, that it would allow something like suffering. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you're asking me if there's something that I don't understand and that could possibly be God?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't, I mean, that possibility is always there. I don't have any evidence to say or to make the claim that I would think, oh, well, that could be some kind of creator. Obviously, I'm always open to the argument, and if the evidence points us in that direction, then obviously I'm not against there being a God, right? But so far, all the evidence that we see, the universe is just random, and there is no God, right? So that's my position, is that all the evidence that I've been presented, you know, I can't make the claim. I can't make then the subsequent leap of saying, okay, well, that might be a God, or there is a God.
Okay. And have you ever taken a... go ahead, Dust.
Oh, no. What kind of evidence would compel you that there might be a God, if any?
Yeah, a simple evidence would just be him or her, whatever it is, let's say him for now, a God just presenting himself to us, saying, I'm here, right? Something like that would be extremely beneficial.
Do you think the Bible qualifies as that? Because that's what
I don't. I don't think that the Bible can qualify as sufficient evidence. We have 100 years works, and at some point we should be able to see some kind of creator, right? And so over the last 100 years we haven't seen that, and it would be really easy for...
Jerry, I think we're losing you there for a second.
Uh-oh.
Oh, can you still hear me?
Okay, now you're back. Okay, so you were talking about something over the last 100 years or so, or...
I was just saying, the evidence would just be God just saying, hey, I'm here. That's it. Like, that would qualify. If we can have something that's observable or presentable, right, it's just, okay, you're here, right? It just... We don't shouldn't be asked to believe in God simply on faith. That's my argument.
And then Dustin asked the question about the Bible being that, and you started talking about that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I don't think the Bible is sufficient evidence, because I don't see how the Bible can be used as evidence, because there's so many varying accounts of who actually wrote the Bible. And then there's contradictions within the Bible itself, you know, about the life of Jesus, you know, different miracles that he performed, things like that. So it would be extremely easy for God to just present himself, and then we can all just, you know, get this argument over with. But unfortunately, I haven't seen that evidence.
Do you think... I'd be interested to see which contradictions in the account of Jesus worry you the most, because I had some as well, and that was part of my investigation into faith. But to also to tie to that, the part of what is compelling, I think, about the Bible as an evidence of God is that it is written by so many people and actually over thousands of years, and yet one cohesive, incredibly beautifully complex yet cohesive story, with themes that run through a narrative in such a brilliant way that it really to me is unfathomable that it would be pulled off by human means. And there's a lot of things like that, I think, that for me personally were very compelling, that this was a text of revelation by a supernatural being. And so I guess, I don't know, I'm not sure I track why the multiple authors is a mark against the Bible. Maybe you can clarify?
Yeah. Have you ever read Bart Ehrman?
A little bit. I've never read one of his books in full, but I've read a lot of excerpts and writings.
Okay. I mean, he was a Christian scholar, and then he started studying the Bible, and I just kind of followed his line of thinking. But one of the reasons why I don't find the Bible compelling is because there's a lot of contradictions within the Bible. So I'm drawing a blank right now, honestly, but the contradictions are there, and I mean I can pull them up here on the internet, but yeah. That's just, if you just want to take me at my word, the contradictions are there.
The thing about Bart Ehrman, though, is even he would say that the majority of what you have there is accurate, or at least what was written, because 99% of the contradictions are, you have two texts or a dozen texts where a minor word is changed. Like, did they say their or his, or common penmanship mistakes when you're copying by hand? You know, you change the inflection on a word and it changes the word, and you can go, okay, we know what happened there. It's like when you write the word it twice or something. That's like 99% of the changes. And Bart Ehrman uses that to really inflate the idea that there's a ton of contradictions. There's really not that many that are even worrisome, and certainly none that change theology. And there's a ton of evidence to the veracity of the Old Testament, and really the New Testament, that no other ancient text really has. And so I think the thing about Bart Ehrman that's difficult for me is the arguments just don't, they sell books, but they don't really hold much water when I've read them.
Wait, I lost you on the last part.
Oh, I cut out.
I still got you there. Jerry, are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay.
One second.
Oh, cool. Cool. Yeah, I don't know. Bart Ehrman's arguments seem like, to me anyhow, much ado about nothing. They're like saying there's, you know, all the Bible has just been changed, and really it hasn't. And critical scholarship, even non-believing scholarship, wouldn't agree with it. And Bart Ehrman's, you know, inflating when 98-99% of the quote unquote changes are like minor textual issues, like you switch one pronoun for another, or you have you know, somebody's in handwriting, you know, you switch out words, or maybe you've switched a section of text with another section, common human errors like that. It just doesn't seem very compelling. Maybe there's an argument he's made that I'm missing there, but.
And see, I'm not familiar with his writing, so I honestly kind of chime in on this one. So.
Yeah. No, I mean, like I said, I'm not super current on his writings. It was just about a year ago that I read his book. But let's take the Bible at its word, right? It's just, let's say everything in the Bible was real. That to me even just seems, so take the story of Jesus, for example. That story seems cruel to me. If that is a revelation of God, that God, or God himself, right, his son, was sacrificed for our sins, that seems cruel. So if everything in the Bible is real, then I wouldn't want to follow a God. Let's say at this point, okay, I'll grant you, let's say God is real and he did present himself through Jesus and sacrificed his son for our sins. That just seems cruel. Why? There are so many better ways to teach people a lesson rather than having somebody suffer at the cross, dying and then resurrecting, right? There's millions of better ways to teach somebody a lesson. So So granted, okay, I can grant you everything that's in the Bible without all the contradictions. Let's say there is no contradictions, right? But that to me is where I find the evidence less and less compelling, because if you think about how you would raise somebody or how you would teach somebody a lesson, that sacrificing something, a loved one, would be the last thing I would think of doing in order to teach somebody something, right? And so that's ultimately my
if you give me 120 seconds, I'll try to explain to you why it's beautiful. And you can tell me if I'm wrong or not. Would you be willing? Okay, so this also points to the beauty of a Bible written by multiple authors over thousands of years. Beginning of the book, you are in the Garden of Eden, and you have original sin, and ultimately all sin is against God. All wrongdoing, whether or not it's against human, it's against God, because it's disobeying God's moral law. And he says, with that original sin, the consequence is death. And what represents death better? And it's not just physical death, it's also spiritual death. But what represents death better than a bloody sacrifice? It is brutal. So throughout the Old Testament, you have a sacrificial system whereby sin is atoned for with blood sacrifices. And that system gets built out and repeated and repeated, knowing that these don't fully atone for sin, but they're a symbol of a full atonement to come. When you get to Jesus, he is the man that lives the perfect life that Adam and Eve, representing all creation, really, no man can do. They can't pull it off. And then God solves the problem. The only man that could possibly pull it off is God come as a man. So that's where you get the incarnation. And then you have the problem of every human sin to be atoned for. And you've built this sacrificial system whereby blood is the payment for sin or death, really. So if all sin is against God, God has to pay the price. When you forgive somebody for their sin against you, it costs you. If JMO steals $500 from me and I choose to forgive him, it will cost me $500. If someone kills my child and I choose to forgive them, it cost me an immense emotional personal cost. The only one who can really pay the cost for all human sin is God. And as God in the flesh, with this sacrificial system on display, he chooses to go to the cross, not because he has to, but because of his love for us. And the way you know in economics, right, the way you know how anything is worth anything is what someone's willing to pay for it. And if the God of all creation, an eternal God, all-powerful, all-loving, all-knowing, sacrifices his life incarnate for sinful human beings, it really is the ultimate price. I mean, that's the highest price that could possibly be paid. And by doing so, he shows that the value of humanity to him is unbelievably ultimate. And it fits into this sacrificial system that's been built out by all these authors. And he's the only one who can pay for sins, and he does it. And that's why all these threads come together on the cross, which is what makes it so beautiful to a Christian. And it is brutal, but that's part and parcel of the whole point of it, is that sin is an awful, brutal thing. And this is an awful, brutal display of the cost of sin. Now, I don't expect that in 120 seconds or whatever that was, you'll believe that. But that's why Christians find it so incredibly beautiful. the depth of the brutality of the cross is part and parcel of the depth of the beauty.
JMO, did you want to respond, or?
I mean, no, I don't know. I've heard the Christian story multiple times, and, like, you know, I grew up on it. I've understood, you know, that principle that Dustin just talked about a lot of different times. And it's not that I necessarily have a problem with that particular thought. For me, the reason that I came to believe in God the way that I believe in God is, you know, I'm probably more of a logic type mind. Faith is a gift that unfortunately I don't think has been bestowed upon me quite yet. But the reason I've come to where I am is because I study the universe, I study the world around me, I study things like that, and that's where I've come more to the understanding of why I believe there is a God, especially when I start to look at things like the anthropic principles and anthropic constants, dark energy, expansion, the multiverse, all those different things, to me, actually scream the existence of a God. And so whether or not I necessarily argue the fact of the Christian story or anything like that, I don't argue those particular points. There's still ones that I'm willing to accept. I'm just not at the point where I think I understand them, and that's why, like I said last time, I pray to understand what I can understand, and then, you know, maybe someday I'll understand it a little bit better. Maybe someday that story will be bestowed upon me and it'll actually, you know, fall onto my heart in a way that it hadn't before, but I don't know that yet. But what I do know is from what, like, I can see and what I can study and what I can understand. So that's kind of where I've come to the belief in God that I have. And it's one of those ones that, like, I don't look at the world around me as essentially as skeptical as maybe some do, because I do believe that there is a God, and I don't look at things like suffering and hate and anger and all those different things in a way that maybe somebody else might, just because I do believe there might be something behind the scenes that I don't necessarily understand, and I've accepted that and I'm okay with that. But that's, I mean, it's not necessarily a response to what Dustin said, I guess, but that's kind of, I guess, when people want to know, like, well, where do I stand, and why do I stand here in these particular ways that I do, that's just kind of who I am, I guess, with that. If that answers your question at all.
So. Yeah.
But
What I hope we don't do in the podcast is, like, talk past one another. There's so many debates that I listen to that people just don't acknowledge each other's points.
And I don't think we're going to do that.
Yeah. So, Dustin, if I'm understanding correctly, you said that it cut off a little bit, but I think I understood no worries. It's just
first world problems.
Technological difficulties, yeah. yeah. So I guess I'll start with what Dustin said about dying on the cross and God voluntarily dying for us on the cross of our sins. That to me, right, as an atheist, just seems cruel and unnecessary. I was born and I didn't commit a sin, I didn't do anything wrong, and the idea that somebody died vicariously for me is sort of appalling, right? I don't want anybody to, and obviously you can respond to everything that I'm saying, but I don't want somebody to, just like I wouldn't want somebody to serve a prison sentence for me, right, or take responsibility for my actions, I wouldn't want God or Jesus to die for the sins, especially for things that I didn't do, right? And I understand that there's a larger theological point, but that's just the way I see it. Every time that story is presented to me, is that's the way I see it. I see it as unnecessary cruelty, and to die so cruelly, right, just on the cross for 3 days to basically dying of thirst and pain is an extremely cruel story, and there's so many better ways to teach somebody how to live their lives, and there's also so many better ways to absolve somebody of their sins, right? And Jameson, to your point, you were more talking about how you believe that there is a creator, but you don't necessarily, you're not necessarily ready to accept the Christian point, right?
It's more along the lines of like, I don't necessarily accept the Christian point, mainly because I do have a lot of problems with the man-made aspects, especially when it comes to the church and things like that. And I do, like you said earlier, I do have some issues, particularly with the Bible and some things that I see, like, in the Old Testament versus the New Testament and things of that nature. But the story that, you know, most Christians will essentially, you know, determine their faith by is, of course, obviously Jesus, the cross, things like that. But my view on God and how I've come more to him, essentially, is just because of what I view in the universe, the different... my study of astronomy, science, and things of those natures, to me, do actually scream the existence of a God, yes. And as far as where, whether or not it's a God of the Bible or anything like that, that I'm not sure of. I think that my relationship with God is probably one that people would view as a non-religious one, like I said, just as a theist, the believer of a deity.
Yeah. I would more or less put you in the deist camp, something along the lines of what a Thomas Jefferson would believe.
You know, that's a good comparison, because he did, like, write his own version of the Bible. You know, he took out different aspects of it and things that he's like, I have problems with this, but I do necessarily believe that this is okay. I think that's a good comparison. Not saying Thomas Jefferson by any means, but...
It's a good comparison.
Hey, don't sell yourself short.
Yeah. So Dustin, I guess we should tackle what Dustin is saying first, so we don't, you know, try to tackle too many things. But so I guess what I'm trying to wrap my mind around is the cruelty of the cross, right? Like the cruelty of having somebody die vicariously for the sins of man. And that's what I've never understood. And that's something, honestly, that I'll never wrap my head around. Is,
well, never say never.
Yeah, right. That just seems so unnecessary and so cruel and so ungodlike, if I can invoke that, right? If I created something, and right, I have my little civilization. I don't know if you ever saw The Simpsons, where like Lisa created a civilization out of her teeth. Mm-hmm. But or if you created something, and you truly love them. You right there, they're yours, or right, or you're just, you don't even love them, you're just trying to teach them the right way, sacrificing yourself or also or sacrificing something that they love seems so unnecessarily cruel, and especially considering how intelligent we are, how prone to reason we are, right? Even a slight nudge will, you know, will steer even the dullest person in the right direction, right? And so that's what I can never wrap my mind around, is that story, is how cruel that story is, and to think that somebody died for, I guess, that larger point of the sins of man is just so unnecessarily cruel. That, so, sure. Yeah, if you want to respond to that.
I get what you're saying, and I think part of the disagreement we had, or the seeing past what we're saying, has to do with the concepts themselves of maybe sin, and why it's such a big deal. And it's not so, the Bible, a huge part of the story of the Old Testament is contradicting what you said there, that, like, you know, you could teach people the right way or nudge them in the right direction, and it's giving you, through snapshots and stories, the picture that God tries that, and he tries it for the purpose of showing it ain't gonna work. And I think that comports with the reality of human history. So much of the evil we commit, whether it's I say something hurtful about JMO, or I'm Joseph Stalin and I murder millions of my own citizens, so much of it is so irrational, and it's so useless. It doesn't, if we were really rational beings, like, we wouldn't do it. And it's just, you know, you give them guidance, they still do evil. You give them a law, they still do evil. You give them more laws, they still do evil. You give them kings, you give them prophets, you get whatever, they still do evil. And what it's the point, the narrative point being made is we're fallen. There's something broken with humanity. And we have the problem that we can both, like a lion doesn't commit evil when it like kills a gazelle, or a shark doesn't commit evil when it rapes its mate. It's just, they don't have moral imperatives. We have a problem where we do. And we can, that was a bit of last podcast's conversation. But I think we all kind of agree that like we have some moral responsibilities regardless of where they do or don't come from, right? And that's a uniquely human problem. Because we actually can't even hold up our own standards, much less God's. And if God's holy, this is why sin matters, because a perfect God executes perfect judgment. And we don't like to talk about judgment very much. Like, we do want it when it's somebody who's wronged us. We love judgment when it's somebody who wronged us. We don't really like it when it's us who's done something wrong. And in order for God to be perfect, which he is, that means he's got to execute perfect justice too. He can't just be perfectly holy. And that's not really a constraint, or at least I don't see it as a constraint upon God. It's just part of the definition of what it would mean to be God. And so if he executes perfect judgment, then he wipes out all sin. And if he wipes out all sin, he wipes out all humanity. The problem is, and this is the conundrum, he loves humanity. At least if, and forgive me, I'm speaking as a Christian. I'm speaking as if the Bible's true. So, you know, if you or anyone listening isn't a Christian, I don't mean to infer that, you know, you already assume the Bible's true or something like that. But talking inside the story, right, as if Christianity's true, his conundrum created by our sin, which is a conundrum because of the gift of free will, which is necessary for love, is that he has to execute perfect judgment and punish and wipe out sin. And so the only workaround is that God actually absorbs our sin, all the sin of humanity, and in past, present, and future. And the reason he can do that, it's not like J-Mo murders somebody and I take the price for him. If J-Mo murders somebody, murder's a hard example because the murderer can't really take the, or the murderee can't really take the price, but I think larceny is a better option. If J-Mo steals from me, I can forgive him, but I pay the price. And what the Bible's saying is, ultimately, when you follow the logic, all sin is an affront to God. It's an affront to the people involved, but it's an affront to God and his moral law. It's kind of like when the state represents a case, right? It's like you might not have gone into a government building and wronged those government officials, but the affront is against the state, and the state represents the defense in a case or something, or the prosecution in a case. It's kind of like that. Not a perfect parallel, but maybe kind of give you some handles for thinking about it. And so God actually has the ability to forgive it. But forgiveness is never free. That's cheap forgiveness. Real forgiveness of any kind requires a sacrifice. And that's the whole symbolism of the blood sacrifice, plus the whole death aspect of it, being the result of sin. So God, it's not unjust, because God is the offended party. He's just absorbing the cost of the sin. And really, the most brutal part of the cross isn't the physical stuff. It's brutal and awful, and it's about the worst way you could die. But the actual worst part of the cross, if you believe in Christian theology, is the separation from God that happens. So God, being triune, separates himself from himself. He separates his son from the presence of God. And what that would mean in Christian theology is that he separates himself from all goodness. It's essentially hell. That's the definition of hell. It's just like separation from God. So that's the worst part. And that's a hard concept as a human to wrap our heads around, because, you know, we live in a material world. And that's why it has to be brutal, because it has to represent a thing that's far worse. He's showing us the price. And it's a compelling reminder. And to bring it all back around, you can't just nudge people in the right direction. Even the best people can't keep their own moral law, your own rules. Like, you fudge them all the time, you do bad stuff, and a mediocre or a bad person is just, you know, it's beyond the pale. And so it's this problem that just keeps going around and around and around. Our sin begets sin begets sin. I wrong somebody, they wrong somebody because of that wrong. And it's just, it has to be paid for, it has to be punished. Or it has to be paid for one way, punishment or forgiveness. And if forgiveness, then it has to be paid by the one it's against, who's God.
Do you guys mind if I disconnect real quick before I respond to this? Oh. I feel like you guys are going to lose me before I respond. All right. I'll be like 10 seconds.
This is a good point for me to just go grab another beverage.
Word from our sponsors.
Yeah, this is word from our sponsors. Yeah. This is Corona. Thank you. I'll be right back. I'm going to go grab a Corona. Have you ever been to the beaches of Mexico? Grab a Corona.
All right. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
All
right. I'll be right back. I feel like that's better.
I'll let you guys go ahead and respond, but I'll be back in a sec.
All right. Awesome. I guess I should grab a refill real quick.
I think I'm the only one on. Am I the only one on?
No, I'm here. I just got
back. Oh, dang it. I thought I was running the podcast for a second, man.
I mean, you can if you want to.
My podcast now.
This podcast brought to you by Destin Bank.
I'm renaming it, taking it over.
Well, before Jerry comes back, I'll respond a little bit to what you said.
Feel free. I've talked enough, so go ahead.
Yeah, you're a little chatterbox.
I am a little chatterbox.
No, like, I think you honestly have given one of the best descriptions of the Christian faith that I've heard in a long time. You know, I've talked to, I don't want to throw anybody under the bus, but, you know, different youth pastors and, you know, just other Christians, I should say, that I feel like weren't able to essentially explain that as well as you just did. So I just want to say, like, that was a very, very good explanation of why Christians believe what they do, considering a lot of people, you know, that were essentially raised in the faith and just kind of have believed it aimlessly throughout the years, and they never understood necessarily what the actual sacrifice of Jesus represented, other than he was like, oh, he died on the cross for my sins. How exciting is that? So no, I just want to say that was like a very, very good telling of actually what the Christian faith is, because I also feel like that's lost upon a lot of people these days as well. Like, you know, a lot of people be like, I'm a Christian. Well, what is it being a Christian? They're like,
right.
You know?
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, and I appreciate that. I'll be interested to hear if it was compelling at all to Jerry. Maybe not.
But if nothing else,
it makes sense to me, and I couldn't, you know, I just I don't take lightly. I understand people not believing, because it was hard for me to believe, and I think that I didn't take lightly my conversion, and I didn't take lightly whether or not this was true.
Sure.
Like I had to. One may think it's after hearing my reasons that it's they're not good enough, and that it still can't be true, and that's okay. That's everyone has. No one can be forced into believing it. But at least insofar as it was up to me, I had to really know to a sufficient level that this was true before I could believe. From the beginning, that was important to me. So again, might not be compelling enough for someone, but for me, that was important. It was no fuzzy faith kind of thing.
Sure.
So take that for what you will. I don't know.
No. And that's, I think it's what's good about what you just said. And Jerry, are you back on or no?
Yeah, I'm here. Okay.
Jerry.
No, what I think was good about what you just said is that, you know, it to me does show that we invited the right guest on and not somebody who I just identifies as a Christian. And they're just like, yeah, no, I believe in God. Yeah, no. Yeah. You know, so I think this at least makes it so it's going to be a good conversation. So.
Yeah. There's obviously a lot to what you said. I guess I'll just start by saying I'm not a Christian theologist. Honestly, I've spent the last six, seven years mostly studying Islam. I can explain my reasons why, but
will you come back to that? That's interesting. Like, I don't want you to divert from what you're about to say, but I would love to hear about that.
I think it's probably the same reason that I've been studying it as well. But yeah, Jerry's probably more versed in it than I am. So, but
that is
continue, Jerry.
I don't want to give people the wrong impression either. I'm not a theologist when it comes to Islam either. But as far as Christian theology goes, I'm not a theist, so it's difficult for me to debate a lot of the points that are esoteric to Christianity, right? What you'll continuously hear from me is arguments for essentially saying, what is the point? You know, that essentially is what it comes down to. Like, obviously I'd love to debate actual Christian points, and that's why a lot of the points that I have make sense to me, and they're good points, but ultimately they're going to seem like cheap points to somebody that is a Christian, because you're going to think, oh, I've already thought of that, or I have an answer for that as well, right? So and I'll posit a few of them, right? So you said that, you know, something like real forgiveness requires sacrifice, right? Like, that to me doesn't make a lot of sense. I can forgive somebody for a lot of things, and granted, forgiveness to me doesn't make a lot of sense. If, and this might get a lot or mired in what I think about human behavior and from a neurological point of view, right? I think humans ultimately don't have a lot of choice in their behaviors. I am a strong proponent and a believer and thinker that at a deep level, we don't really have a lot of choice, right? You can put studies on people and you can say, lift your left or your right hand, and most people won't be able to answer why they lifted their left or their right hand, right? So when it comes to a matter of choice and choosing to do something, that's where forgiveness is lost upon me, because ultimately I don't think that people are responsible for their actions. I think that we are just a product of randomness. I think that at a very deep level, we just behave according to the laws of physics, right? So I can totally fudge the next couple of words that I'm going to say, and I would have no explanation as to why I fudge that sentence, right? Or I can say something, you know, incredibly right, brilliant, and I would also have no explanation for why I said this, you know, incredibly, you know, brilliant thing, right? It's just at a very deep level, I don't think people are responsible for their actions. And so when you bring that back to Christianity, when you say something like forgiveness requires a sacrifice, that can, I guess, you know, color in a little my perspective a little bit better, because it shows that, one, I don't think that forgiveness is necessary, because I ultimately don't think people are responsible for their behavior. I think you didn't choose your genetics, you didn't choose your parents, you didn't choose so many of the things that influence your life. And so to say that somebody's responsible and then subsequently to say somebody requires forgiveness, that's where you really start to lose me. So I know that there's a lot there, but you guys can respond as you see fit. So just I wanted to stick on that point about, you know, real forgiveness requires sacrifice. It's just that to me is where a lot of, you know, Christianity loses me, because knowing what I know about how the brain works, you know, real forgiveness should require empathy, not sacrifice.
Do you have a wife? You're married, right?
Yes.
If she's raped today, what do you want to have happen to a rapist?
Well, from a visceral point of view, obviously I'd like to...
Yeah, but if he's not responsible, as you said, we're not responsible for our actions, what would you like to have happen to him? I mean, not like legally.
Yeah. No, yeah. From a visceral point of view, it would... The very visceral reaction that you get is, I would want to kill that person. And not only kill them, but torture them and have as much hatred and torture as that person can conceivably suffer, right? But so take that's a great example, right? So take something as such a visceral reaction as that, take the other aspect of that. What happened to that rapist that made them the way that they are? At some point they were a child, at some point something happened throughout their life that made them who they are. Something is not clicking in their brain correctly. Somebody raped them at some point in their life. Some defect is going on in their brain that if I could give them a pill, if I could give them a magic pill and they would never want to rape again, I would be a cruel person to not give them that pill, right? So, and this can, obviously this is a whole other topic of free will versus determinism, but I think we've talked about this on this podcast before, Jameson, but
yeah, we did.
I am not a determinist, but I am a strong proponent of the fact that we ultimately are very heavily influenced by things that we don't realize that we're influenced. So to answer your question, Justin, about, you know, a rapist, obviously it's reasonable for me to witness somebody like my wife or my sister or a loved one being raped and think and right, being very reactive and think, I want to hurt this person as much as I possibly can. But philosophically, more rationally, you have to take a step back and go, what happened to this person to make them the rapist? Because no ordinary person, no normal person would behave that way. And if I could change their behavior, if I could make them a non-rapist, I would. And that seems like a level of empathy that isn't presented in the forgiveness requires a sacrifice, right? Obviously I wouldn't forgive them, because it'd be unreasonable for me to do that. But deep down, and if it's a very super philosophical conversation, yes, I would ultimately think that that person is not responsible for that action.
But I get the empathy part, but if he's not actually responsible, there's a difference between complexity of influence and no responsibility. And if he's not actually responsible, you can't actually make a legal case that he did anything wrong. That's the problem. Like, you can't, if we're chemical machines just like responding to factors in our lives, like, you can't, I don't really think you can like hold like the, what was it, the Nuremberg trials for Germany. Like, I don't think you can convict those guys. You can't convict anybody of anything. You can just, you can lock them away so they don't hurt people, but you can't say anything's wrong, and you can't say anyone deserves punishment for anything.
If you,
and it seems empathetic, but it also seems cheap to me. Like, that there's no cost to our behaviors, that we have no responsibility. You also can't take credit for anything you do.
Yeah, that's, I mean,
anything good, you know what I mean? You can't say, well, man, I really did a great job on this project, yeah. Or I did it, you know, there's no responsibility.
And I don't want to keep interjecting here over Jameson, but
no, please, by all means, continue.
So both of you guys are obviously very intelligent. You guys, some of the most intelligent people that I've spoken to. Where do you get your intelligence? Do you take credit for it, or have you actually spoken to somebody that you immediately speak to them, you're like, this person's not with it, right? You look at this person and you go, this person is trying their hardest, but they're not intelligent. And you guys, I speak to you guys, and it's just, you're both incredibly intelligent. You both get very complicated subjects. So yes, Dustin, to your point, I don't take credit for the things that just happened, right? I don't take credit for wanting to read more, being curious, being skeptical. I don't take credit for that. I want to do it, and there is some level of influence that I do take credit for the hard work that I do, because it is hard work, but...
But you can't take credit for the hard work. That's part of your chemical makeup and your influences in your life.
Exactly. Yeah, so I can... As far as I can take credit, it's just to continue to influence me, and I feel like we can influence people to behave a certain way, right? We jail people up because we want them to stop committing that action, right? So take Jeffrey Epstein, for example, right? We jailed Jeffrey Epstein because we want pedophiles to realize that there's a consequence to molesting underage girls. We don't want some potential pedophile to go, yeah, you know what, I can just get away with it. We don't want that.
But that only makes sense if there's a choice. If they can actually make a choice, like they're responsible.
Well, there is, to a certain extent, we can influence people. We can influence behavior, right? What we can do is say, right, if, and this is why I guess society exists, is we can influence people's behavior to behave, and we can, you know, people are malleable. They're not fixed on a path. This is why I don't agree with determinism. I don't think that there's a fixed path for history. I don't think there's a fixed path for people. I think people are malleable, and we can, you know, influence them in a certain way. But I know this is getting super far and away from the original thing about what we were talking about, but, you know,
I don't even remember what the original thing was, to be perfectly honest.
Well, yeah, you had brought up that you know one of the main points was you thought that, you know, why God sacrificed himself was because, you know, forgiveness ultimately requires, you know, that sacrifice. And so I had brought up the fact that I don't think, you know, why I don't find the Bible credible for me is because of the way that I think about, you know, our neurology, right? It's just, I think that the brain works in very different ways than the Bible would invoke, right? So how would free will tie into, I guess, what you would believe, and especially tying into, you know, notions about forgiveness and dying on the cross and, you know, God voluntarily choosing to die for our sins. You know, how would you, yeah, you know, I guess, how would you tie in free will versus, you know, what I said, which I guess you could classify more as a determinist point of view?
Yeah, and to be fair, I realize you're not, as you said, claiming full determinism like maybe Sam Harris or somebody would. But I guess the point I was, you know, making was that if there's even a fraction of responsibility, then there's responsibility. but as far as free will goes, it to me, and I should preface this by saying there's the word free will that we use in common parlance, and the word free will in more of a neuroscience, brain chemistry kind of meaning, and then free will in the theological sense, and they're all a little bit different. So it can get dicey when we say free will, but in general, I think we're all kind of tracking on the same page here. But free will is a necessary condition for love. I think logically, any way you slice it, if there is no free will, or if we are fully determined in our behavior, love has no meaning. You're just responding to chemical influences and conditions in your social upbringing, genetics, things like that. There's nothing profound or transcendent or meaningful, really, in it. And so, I mean, in order to have an like actual love, you have to have actual free will. And that is, it's part and parcel with the whole cross story, because the whole reason you have sin is because in order to have love, you have to create a people who have the ability to not love or to sin. And it's a risk, but it's a beautiful risk if it's a precondition for love. Because God could have created automatons, real determinist creatures that just do what they do or do what they're programmed to do. Then there's no capacity for love. So I don't know if what you were wanting to get out of me on a question there, but at least in some sense, and maybe you can delve further, probe further, but that's one of the necessities of having free will.
Yeah, I think free will probably sort of inadvertently gets to the heart of the disagreement between us. But
What do you mean by free will? I'd be interested to know that, actually.
Yeah, I think a lot of us, when we think of free will, we think we have the ability to choose, right? It's just we can choose, right? Something as trivial as raising your left or your right hand, right? We have, no matter how much influence is over us, we can choose as we like, right? So you can choose to get angry, you can choose to get excitable, you can choose to love somebody, you can choose not to love somebody, right? And so that's what free will means. It's just sort of that libertarian approach to just, there's some influence, but not really, and I am just free to choose as I please, right? If I wanted to kill somebody, I can. If I wanted to be the most altruistic person, I can, and I deserve every bit of credit for that, right? So, yeah, that's what I mean by free will.
Gotcha. And you think we do have free will to some degree? Albeit a complex set of inputs, but you're saying, yeah. I'm just trying to get clear to you. You're saying we do have free will, but it's influenced heavily by outside factors or inside factors, I guess, too.
I think, honestly, I don't know what I think about free will. I know okay. that Fair. We're heavily, yeah, I know that we're heavily influenced by our genetics. Just a little bit of background about me. I'm a microbiologist. I have my degree in microbiology, so I studied genetics for a large part of my career in college. So I know how heavily influenced we are by genetics. So I know that one, we're influenced by genetics. Two, we're influenced by our environment. You're influenced by where you were raised, how you were raised, things like that. And then three is that gap where I'm not sure where our ability to choose really comes in, because if you take all of these things, right, it's like, where do we really have choice? So that's essentially where I struggle with free will. So yeah, there's just to answer that question. I've been trying to take a few notes here. I would just wanted to clarify something that Jameson said. I don't think people shouldn't be accountable for their actions. I think that there should be repercussions, because unfortunately, we don't have a great way to influence people to not do certain things, right? So like murder, rape, I feel like we need a way to influence people against, you know, committing those actions and committing those crimes. So that's, I don't think people should be just getting away because they're not accountable. I just think we need a way to influence people, and jail is, for the time being, a great way to influence those actions.
But I guess I didn't think I said that.
I don't think you said that, but I just okay. I didn't want people to get that impression that I thought people, you know, should just be free to behave as they wanted to.
So you're clarifying on something you said. Okay, I'm sorry.
I misunderstood.
I was like, I didn't think I said that, but okay. I mean, I might have.
Yeah.
I got a panic over here because there's a hailstorm going on outside, so who knows what I've said.
Oh. And then, Dustin, you said you wanted to touch back on the Islam thing. I guess if you wanted, I can clarify that. The reason I got so into Islam is really the reason why everybody started to get into it, is because we had nonstop terrorist attacks, and then you also had the rise of Islamic groups, you know, ISIS, Jabhat al-Nusra in Syria. So that's really where I started to think and realize that I had absolutely no knowledge. So I guess a little bit of a backstory. I come from a very liberal family. Very, very left wing. I mean, my dad is from Mexico. Mexico, if you don't know much about it, was pretty much a socialist country for the last 70 years. There was a lot of, you know, strife between atheists and Catholics. Mexico is very Catholic, but also a very atheist country. My dad was very atheist, but also very to the left. My mom was pretty much part and parcel of progressive, but she was Christian. So I grew up kind of on the Chomsky side of the left, thinking that, you know, I followed everything that Michael Moore did, right? I just thought that America was pretty much the worst thing that ever happened to this world. Enter reality 2010 when I joined the Air Force, 2014 when I realized that that's not the reality of the world, right? I was of a very strong thinking that everything that America did was influencing the people of the Middle East, and, you know, essentially America was responsible for creating these jihadi groups. I got hit in the face by reality, by, you know, the reality truck. That's not the case at all, and this is where I sort of developed an insatiable hunger for understanding what these groups actually were wanting to do, right? And so I got really into Islam because I wanted to know why people like Muhammad Atta, the leader of the Hamburg cell that eventually crashed that plane into the World Trade Center, really did what he did. And this was essentially because he really did what he did because he believed wholeheartedly that he was leading a crusade against the infidels or against, you know, the West. This set me off on that path to truly understand what all these groups were ultimately trying to accomplish, right? These groups are trying to establish a caliphate. They're trying to establish a worldwide caliphate where either you submit. Islam means submission. Muslim means one who submits. They're trying to establish a worldwide caliphate where, and you can get into the Islamic eschatology where Jesus comes back and then he fights alongside the Mahdi against, you know, the Antichrist, and then we all live in this caliphate, or you can live as a dhimmi, you know, second-hand citizen. But right, this is where I started to get into all these, really trying to understand what these groups were really doing. So, you know, kind of a long-winded way to explain why I got so into Islam and why I saw so much cruelty and so much violence coming out of the Middle East and Southeast Asia, and going, what the fuck is going on over there? Like, why are these people just blowing themselves up constantly? So yeah, it was a long-winded way of saying why I got into Islam.
Oh, hold on real quick, Jerry and Dust. My battery is about to die on this recorder, so I'm just going to swap it out real quick. All right, we're recording again.
Oh, okay. So yeah. Dustin had asked me... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, well, you're about to recap what I recapped. I asked you... First of all, I said your story of your... that snapshot of your life was fascinating. And then... I asked you when you became or decided or realized you were an atheist, and you said...
Yeah, I said, so my dad was always an atheist, and this comes from a lot of his upbringing in Mexico, because Mexico's has a sort of an inner atheist versus Catholic war, but he's from a very socialist left. But I had never really considered atheism as a position. It wasn't until about 2011, 2012 that my brother introduced me to all these videos from Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris, and you know, these people were out there debating every theist left and right, and this is when I really got into these videos and, you know, essentially started to realize that, okay, well, you know, especially Islam is one of the most predominantly troubling theologies that we deal with. It is the most troublesome theology that we have to deal with, right? If we can all live together in this perfect world and Christianity really is not going to bother anybody, but Islam unfortunately is a reality that we all have to deal with. It's not something that we can just go, this is just going to go away in a couple of years. It's not, unfortunately. So yeah, I guess right around 2012 is when I started to become, or I guess when I became an atheist.
Awesome. How old were you?
21. Yeah. J-O. Turned 30 in 4 days.
Woo! 30.
Congrats.
30.
Yeah. Dustin, you're about to ask something.
I was just giving you space to interject.
Oh, so no, it's...
This is a safe space.
This is a safe space, Jamil. You know this is your podcast. I don't know if you know this.
Well, you know, it's mine and Jerry's, but speaking of...
Oh, that's right. Yours
and
Jerry's.
Speaking of safe spaces...
Sorry,
Jerry.
What a jerk.
I have this doll over here, and I can show you where the youth counselor touched me, if you'd like. no, actually, that's kind of one of the things that, speaking of Islam, this is going to sound weird, but this is one of the things that bonded Jerry and I, is the Islamic faith. But, you know, it's kind of we were both kind of studying it at the same time, and Jerry much more so than I was, and I was just, you know, I was watching little videos and snippets that I'd find on Facebook and YouTube that I already kind of knew it was... something that was definitely a problem. And Jerry and I one day, we like actually sat down, and like he'd been dating my cousin for a little while now, and you know, we were just having brewskis or something like that, and then we started talking about the Islamic faith, and I was like, you know, these are some of the problems I have. And then Jerry's like, well, let me open up this can of worms for you a little bit more, buddy. And then he loaned me a book from Sam Harris, and ever since then, yeah, I've just been kind of devouring whatever I can as far as, you know, different problems that I have with the Muslim faith and, you know, different parts of the theology that's behind it that I've just found very disturbing. And so that's kind of been one of the things that bonded Jerry and I over the years, because, like I said, we both just, I think, have a very, very similar, if not almost identical, view on Islam. And it's still one of my hobby horses to study whenever, you know, like a new article or video or something like that pops up on like a news feed or video that I'm or YouTube, and I'm like, ooh, this is interesting, still worth studying. And I think it's talked about less and less now, which is kind of crazy, just because I feel like a lot of people now just want to keep talking about Trump did this, Trump did that, and I don't think people are talking about Islam as much, unless it's the whole like Trump's banning all Muslims, blah, blah, blah type thing. But anyway, that's a whole other topic for a whole other podcast right there. So,
yeah.
But, no, that's...
You know, you've brought us, both of you, really, into the topic that we talked about talking about, which was religion and politics.
That's true. We did.
Like, somehow we ended up there, guys.
We've come full circle.
Yeah. Fell into my trap.
Well, then, then let me just propose the question like this, then. And we'll start with Dustin. So how has your religious views shaped your political and science background?
My faith, anyone's faith, anyone's worldview, maybe call it that, is one of the most basic foundational things that shapes everything you think about. So inevitably, it shapes the way I think about politics, the way I form views on policies, the way I understand everything. And I think that's basically true for everybody. You know, whatever makes up one's worldview. And we can maybe discuss what that means. But as far as specific ways, I mean, the teachings of Jesus compel, at least I hope they do, my views on things like immigration or welfare or social conditions, marriage, you know, all kinds of things, fiscal policy. So I think it's what's dangerous about politics and religion is that anytime religion is inevitably political and probably vice versa too. So I don't necessarily think that I understand the impulse to keep them separate, but it's really just impossible unless you don't take your worldview or your faith seriously at all. But if you have any seriousness to it at all, it's just impossible to keep them separate. Everyone's making moral decisions. That's what laws are. You're imposing your moral views onto laws. But the danger then is conflating the two. And for me, faith is the primary thing, not to be the primary thing that influences politics. Politics being downstream from culture, also downstream from religion. And when religion, or Christianity in particular, I think, gets conflated with politics and power, bad stuff follows. I think there's a handful of reasons for that, but one of them is people start to take their own personal opinions on, or they take views that can have a reasonable variety of differences or disagreements or whatever, and they put them up on the same pedestal as their religious or theological beliefs, which then if you disagree with me, you're basically a heretic. And that creates a lot of problems. Now, that doesn't mean I don't take my religious views seriously. I think that's probably evident over the last several conversations we've had. But I think that's where people get uncomfortable about religion and politics, and I totally understand.
Hmm. Jerry?
Yeah. Fanatical views, thinking people are heretics, is not only a problem with religion, it's also a problem, one of the most predominant problems on the left. The left is honestly having its own purge on people because they can't figure out what it is that they actually believe. If you're not the most woke, if you're not the most, you know, alert, right, the most alert on your white privilege or whatever it is, then you're out of the group. And yeah, I agree. I don't think you should treat people as heretics just because they think slightly different than you. I think people, a variety of political opinions is always good. And yes, we all, obviously we're all shaped by our beliefs about our ethics, right? Just we're all going to have slightly different ethical positions. I can agree, I can sympathize with cops when it comes to shootings. That shouldn't make me or immediately disqualify me from, you know, presenting a position on gun control or abortion or whatever it might be, right? And this is a problem that we're faced with in current politics, is that people are so quick to just discount somebody's perspective because they don't immediately agree with somebody, right? It's just we need to purge all of our thought process from that, right? We need a difference of opinion. We need good ideas wherever we might find them, and we can't have groupthink. We can't have people just always thinking the same thing, because that way is honestly just one of the worst ways to think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, and to kind of highlight your guys' point with the people essentially not wanting to listen to you if you have that different point of view. You know, a person that was very close to me for a while, she and I were having a conversation one day, and she brought up a point, and I don't necessarily remember what the point was that she was trying to make, but I disagreed with it. And by simply saying, like, I disagree, and then I brought up just a quick little excerpt of why I disagreed, and it was not even a 2-minute counter to what the 10 minutes that I just let her speak before. You know, she kind of shut me off right then and there. Like, I don't want to talk about this anymore. And it did bother me, that aspect that, like, well, just because we have a difference of opinion that we might actually, you know, I can have a logical conversation with you based on a difference of opinion, but the fact that you are now emotionally upset that I disagree with you, I thought that was pretty radical. To the extent where what's that?
Well, why do you? Well, I'd be interested to see why you guys think that is. Like, I assume that's always been a pretty human problem, but it does seem exacerbated.
I think it's been exacerbated more lately than it has been in the last maybe 50, 60 years. Like, granted, I wasn't around 50, 60 years ago, so I can't necessarily speak to that. And it's just from my own observations, but I just feel like kind of something that Jerry said, you know, earlier, you know, it seems like, especially with people that identify as being left, like, the more woke you are, the more closed off you are to other ideas. And
I
go ahead.
I think Jerry hit on a really good point there, that you said something to the effect of they're trying to figure out what they believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's not that this doesn't happen with religious folks, but there seems to be an eating of one's own going on in the left wing of politics right now. Like you said, it's like, this month you might be woke, next month you might be a racist and a bigot because you're not. And there's a progressing to the progressivism that inevitably can't stop. Because if progression is the progressing to, you know, more and more left-wing ideas further and further left is the goal, I don't see how that stops, and it sort of eats its own. And I hope that doesn't sound like I'm saying the right wing's great and there's no problems. No, it does seem, as long as we're on that topic, it does seem to be kind of an acute problem where, you know, like, Joe Biden to me seems like a fairly reasonable guy, but he's like, I mean, the way people are, I know it's an election cycle, but the way people talk about him, you'd think he, like, murdered a bunch of baby seals. And you know what I mean? And it seems like that problem keeps happening over and over, and it happens every election cycle, but the extent to which it's happening right now is breathtaking.
Yeah. Well, and it's probably got to be exhausting at some point, or to some degree, because it seems like every week they have a new set of rules that they need to play by.
And I think that's the thing. What, like, the you don't have a defined, maybe, I mean, I don't know. It just seems like there's no concrete definition of this is what we believe or this is what we stand for. It's just like, push it further. That's what we believed last month, you know? And things that were like standard in a couple of years ago, and even in the midterm election, things that were totally acceptable do not seem acceptable anymore. And that was not that long ago. It's an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah, even watching something like The Office, you know, if you look at interviews from today, yeah, people are like, oh, no, that seems taboo now. Like, I would never make that joke now. And it's just...
Totally.
Office was not that long ago. It was, 10 years ago?
Yeah, or there's totally. Even... somebody brought up an example recently of the first Ace Ventura movie. Like, how that scene where Jim Carrey found out that he was actually kissing a man... and like that person is a transvestite, and now that like they make him the bad guy in that movie. If that same movie was made now, people would have just a complete and total conniption over the fact that the tranny in that movie is the bad guy, and that people are disgusted by the fact that they kissed a tranny. Like, that's something now that people would look at and just be like, oh my gosh, you can't do that. That is so offensive to the LGBT community, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, I mean, 20 years ago, people were a little bit more lighthearted, but still, I mean, it's yeah, you can't seem to do anything these days without offending somebody.
And there's always going to be people that, are offended, and always going to be people that look to be offended by anything that you say. And one of the most sinister or, you know, malicious things about our politics today is that we just can't take another opinion. And that's honestly why we started this podcast, is because we realized that there's people that want to have a difference of opinions. And me and Jameson, and, you know, even all of us here, me, you, and Dustin, right? We don't have the same opinion, but we're not here yelling at each other and, you know, taking our clothes off and just, you know, screaming bloody murder at a difference of opinion, right? We can still have a conversation. It's very, you know, erudite, and it's very, you know, civil, and we're not, you know, trying to rip each other's throats out, trying to get each other, you know, fired from our jobs. And that is so prevalent in today's culture, and it just needs to stop. Like, it's just, you're never going to have a functioning society if your first impulse is to get somebody fired or to get somebody, you know, ostracized or pilloried.
Mm-hmm. To be fair, Jerry, you don't know if J-Mo took his clothes off.
Yeah.
You can't possibly know that.
9 times out of 10, the answer's yes. They were off.
Yeah. I love that meme of that World of Warcraft guy. He's like, I don't know if you guys have ever seen that. It's like, that guy must have no life. He's just like there eating Cheetos and stuff.
I think South Park nailed the World of Warcraft guy perfectly.
Yeah.
But yeah, to be fair, you don't know if I took my clothes off or not, so.
Yeah.
There's no telling. man, what a disturbing thought.
Jameson with no clothes?
Jameson taking his clothes off.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well,
it's been a little over an hour and a half this time. We're probably about an hour 45 minutes. I mean, like I said last time, people tend to start kind of, I don't want to say losing their interest, but people have short attention spans, to say the least. And I think this is probably a good point to start wrapping it up. So.
Yeah. No one's still listening at this point. It's just the three of us.
No.
They lost interest when Jameson took his clothes off. So
the last two listeners tuned out right there.
They're like, yeah. I'm done. Nudity too far.
Dustin, if honestly, like, we've talked a lot about religion, but if you wanted to just come back on and talk about something just normal, like, not
whatever
being,
man, yeah,
so deep, like, yeah, I think you'd be a great guest, just to have you on, just to get your opinion on stuff. It doesn't have to be so dense all the time. You know, not dense in like a bad way, but you know what I mean? Like where we have to parse every word that we say.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something a little bit less ponderous.
Yeah, exactly.
Slightly lighter fare.
Yeah.
Maybe in the future we could talk, or next episode we could talk about the future of humanity. I mean, something a little lighthearted. Yeah.
Something a little lighter. Yeah, just like that.
You know, nothing that's going to require us to possibly freak out at all.
Yeah.
But obviously, Dustin, you and I go back for years, so I'm always happy to have you back on. I don't feel like I don't feel like our friendship is probably going to be ended by this podcast, so I think we're good there.
He just unfriended you on Facebook.
So. It's over, dude. It's over.
It's Facebook.
I'll come back on for Jerry.
It's official.
You're dead to me.
Fine. Yeah. I only gave your child cake when I last saw him. It's fine.
You did.
But yeah, guys. Closing notes. We do now have an Instagram page. It's just the Owl Podcast is our Instagram page. You can find us on Twitter as well, which is owl_podcast. Our email address is theowlpodcast@gmail.com, and our website is theowlpodcast.fireside.fm, and that's F as in Frank, M as in Mary. We're on Apple, iTunes, Stitchers, Google Play. I mean, you can find us wherever. Do you guys have any closing thoughts?
Nope.
I really like both you guys.
Oh, thanks, buddy.
Yeah.
Closing thought.
Nah, you ruined it.
way to make it gay, Dustin.
And cut that out.
If anybody was listening, we just offended the last person. So
I can hear Jerry blushing.
Cool. All right, guys. Well, I appreciate it, and you both have a great weekend.
You too.
Same to both of you.
Take care, guys.
Right. Bye.
Later.
See ya.